Hello all, welcome to the track C of the Ontology Summit 2014. The track is called Overcoming Ontology Engineering Bottlenecks. This is February 6, 2014, and this specific first session of the track is about strategies and building blocks. So thanks of all for all of you to be here. Let me first introduce the co-champions of this track. This is Matthew West, Pascal Hitzra, and myself. Before I will announce the speakers, and we can dive right into their talks, let me very briefly introduce you once more to the idea behind the track. So let's please advance to slide 2 of the introductory slides. This is called the Overcoming Ontology Engineering Bottlenecks slide. And you will see we have a track mission here. This is to identify bottlenecks that hinder the large-scale development and reusage of ontologies and identify ways to overcome these bottlenecks. As you can see in the tiny link posted on the very right bottom of the slide, we identified several bottlenecks and potential solutions. They're all on the Ontolog Wiki. I'm just mentioning three of them here, namely those three that we will address during this week's session. So one of the bottlenecks that we identified are modeling axioms of knowledge representation languages that may cause difficulties in terms of either that they increase the reasoning complexity or the increase or decrease the reusability of the ontologies. And we have a speaker that is exactly an expert on that, namely Karl Hammer is one of our speakers today. And among the potential solutions we identified was the development of reusable patterns and hoping that those patterns will enable large-scale ontology development and also ease the alignment between ontologies. And we also have the world's leading expert on that topic, Aldo Gangemi. And then another potential solution we identified was purpose-driven modeling granularities and more or less the question of whether we need an additional ontology modeling language in addition to ontology engineering languages or knowledge representation languages. And we have an expert for that topic as well today, Werner Kuhn from UCSB. If we advance now to slide 3 is called Strategies and Building Blocks Session, then you see that we put some questions in there. I'm not going to say that we will have answers to all of them, but you will see that the three speakers address some of those questions, and I hope that in our joint discussion after those three talks, we will chat and talk about some of those questions. I'm not going to read out all of these questions, but of course, once you think about patterns, the question is how would you arrive at those patterns? Once you decide that patterns are useful, there are a couple of interesting questions. Some of them have been already answered, and probably Aldo will talk a bit about that, namely, you know, how many patterns are there? Are there types of patterns? Are some patterns or all patterns domain independent? Can we use machine learning and KDD technologies to mine patterns from existing data and related questions like that? Then there are also more social or cultural questions or organizational questions, namely once we develop such patterns, how do we maintain them? How to get community buy-in for such patterns? Are there measures or at least experience reports whether some patterns are more usable or more robust than others, and so forth and so forth. Then, of course, as I mentioned before, there is the question about how to abstract from individual ontology design. So this leads us to the question whether there is a higher level ontology modeling language that can be used to create better knowledge representations using the existing languages. And finally, as I mentioned before, how to get community buy-in. And also, of course, the question that you saw on my slide before, namely which specific language constructs to avoid or to select and how scalability of reasoning behaves with respect to those. So this is slide 3. Let's move to slide 4 now, which introduces the speakers. Our first speaker is Werner Kuhn from the University of California, Santa Barbara. Our second speaker is Aldo Gangemi from University Paris 13, and our third speaker is Karl Hammer from Jönköping University. We will start with Werner. Werner, can you give me a brief okay that you're ready to go? Star 7 to unmute.
Here I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, very well. So Werner will be our first speaker. Werner hosts the Jack and Laura Dangerman Endowed Chair in Geography at the University of California, Santa Barbara. You can find his bio on the Ontolog Wiki. I would just rather give you a personal introduction. Werner Kuhn is, I think, the world's leading figure in geosemantics, so semantics and ontologies applied to the realm of GI science and also geodata maybe more broadly. And what I especially like about his work is that Werner's roots are in user interfaces and usability studies, and I think that in his ontology engineering and geosemantics work, this usability and human-centric perspective always shines through, which I think is quite exciting. Today, Werner will talk about abstracting behavior in ontology engineering. Werner, the stage is all yours now for 20 to 25 minutes. After 20 minutes, I will give you an update that you have only 5 minutes left to go. Looking forward to your presentation.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Jano. And good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night, whatever it may be. Very happy to have this opportunity. It's my first time on a track of the Ontology Summit, so if I'm logistically not behaving correctly, please point it out to me. The topic, as Jano has introduced already, topic of my talk at least, is raising that question again that has been on the overhead on the introductory slides. How can we find better guidelines, maybe techniques, maybe languages, maybe tools to come up with usable, reusable ontology design patterns? And in some ways, and Jano hinted at this a little bit, it's old hats what I'm telling you. It seems to me that over the decades, we are asking this very question with slightly different vocabulary every few years again, maybe every decade again. It may have started with programming languages and abstraction constructs in them, late 60s, early 70s. It went on to databases, then in general knowledge representation languages and models, user interfaces, and now we are at the ontology topic and we raise the same question again. How do we abstract? How do we avoid things to get unwieldy, too complex, unstructured, hard to keep track of, hard to integrate, hard to share, hard to document? All these questions I think I've seen over the decades being raised and to some extent answered. And of course, the point of the talk today is to mostly remind all of us that there are actually pretty good answers out there in the literature. Not that I know all these answers or have all these answers. I will focus on one particular idea that I think goes back at least to Dave Parnas' work that he did on software engineering in the 60s, 70s, Barbara Liskov, John Gutak at MIT, and others who have early on found that it is really helpful if we have these kind of abstraction challenges. For example, we have vocabularies that overlap, that seem to be describing the same thing in different ways, that grow too big. If we have these types of problems, at the time it was in programming languages, then it may be a good idea to abstract, of course, but to abstract in a particular way, and that is abstracting the behavior, abstracting from the details that maybe related to the structuring or to the naming of things or internal details, abstracting from them by what was called and still is called information hiding, and looking at, so what behavior do these animals that we're talking about share? And that's the basic idea I want to talk about. I'm moving to my slide number 2. Since the topic of the track is, and in fact the summit is ontology engineering bottlenecks, I'm reusing a slide here that I've used when talking to semantic web experts before, and I'm trying on this slide on the left-hand side with the bottle in the background to show the process that we today necessarily have to go through when we deal with semantics, when we deal with conceptual models of any kind. At the top, we have what I would call meaningful communication as we have it between humans. And we have to take away quite a few things from this meaningful communication, going down on the left-hand side, and each step that we take down towards the bottleneck or through the bottleneck, at each step we throw out a few things out of the window. And that's just my view of it, and of course it's slightly different in various contexts. But obviously when we focus just on concepts, whatever we mean by concepts, but we're already leaving away quite a few things that are important for meaningful communication. Especially we are often leaving away the context within which these concepts are being used. And then further, we often equate concepts with words. And we, by doing this, we lose again, the properties, the influence on meaning that arises from things that are not expressed in words and by the different ways that words are being used, which is often called pragmatics. And then from the words, by applying formalisms, by applying logic, we go down to predicates, some sort of predicates, usually first order logic or then even further, reduce that even further. And by that, we lose algebraic structure, structure in general, that is useful to talk about the concept. What is the behavior associated with that concept, for example? And then among these predicates, we often pick out very peculiar predicates, namely what logicians call sort laws. And these are the things like all white things or all things that are wine. And then we are trying to combine these sorts again to produce a white wine concept that supposedly is the overlap of white things with wine things. And we all know that this is maybe not the ideal way of representing the meaning of white wine. And then from modeling sortals or considering sortals, we go further down in the bottleneck, and that's where the bottleneck becomes really narrow and represent all of these predicates by sets. And it has been well documented in the cognitive science, cognitive linguistics literature, that sets are one possible model, but certainly not the best, and with many shortcomings of semantics. Of how we use terms and how, for example, birds are structured semantically. There are more typical birds, and there are less typical birds, even those that don't fly. So this idea of prototypes goes out the window. And then, as I've indicated with the white wine example, we use fairly simple mathematical operations on these sets, intersectional, etc., and subsetting. We lose, as many experts among you, Jan among them, we lose easy ways of dealing with similarity and other reasoning techniques than those based on subsumption. So that's a bit of a drastic view, and in fact, when I used this last time with semantic web people, many of them felt a bit offended because they felt I was criticizing things like description logic, etc. There's nothing wrong with description logic. We just need to be aware of what the power of even weaker things like RDF or higher level or first order logics and higher level logics are, and need to be aware what we lose or gain by employing them. So I'm moving on to the third slide, which is an extract from schema.org that I'm using thanks to Ross Purvis, who found that. And of course, it's a bit tongue-in-cheek. Don't take this too seriously, but it's an illustration of what can happen when we lose certain things, throw certain things out of the window, and just build essentially subsumption hierarchies of concepts where suddenly mountains, which obviously are a kind of a landform, and landforms may be kinds of places, and places are kinds of things, but suddenly by doing this inheritance hierarchy, we end up with mountains having fax numbers. So, coming back to the topic of ontology design patterns, what can we do to counteract that loss of rich semantic information? That we, at least to counteract the loss that we don't want to incur. I've been fascinated by this drive towards ontology design patterns, and I've been happy to participate in some of the efforts to come up with them. But early on, and the longer I've been involved in this work, I've been wondering, so what are our tools of the trade here? It's one thing to say that we should have increased possibilities of reuse and modularity. We should be able to construct building blocks and then design our ontologies by using more or less standardized building blocks. And we should be able to capture more semantics and many other desirable features that these patterns actually have. But how do we find them? Not the features, but the patterns. How do we, in a given practical situation, for example, we might be modeling ontologies for transportation applications, navigation, transportation, logistics, any of these things. We have lots of ontologies out there. We have vocabularies that are in use. We have conceptual schemas. We have international standards. We have road databases that are semantically documented and modeled, road classes and so on. How do we, in that richness of vocabularies, how do we get to the point where we can highlight certain patterns, make them more stable, make them reusable? And it seems to me that while we're doing a great job on identifying patterns, and there's certainly nothing wrong with coming up with as many interesting patterns and letting them sort of sort out as we can, there's still a question, at least from when I wear my academic hat, what's the theory that allows us to do that? What's the theory that allows us to do it better? What's the kind of questions we have to ask before we sit down and design a pattern? So that's the blue question on this slide here. How should we identify, first of all, candidate patterns maybe? Then how should we specify them? And once we have found some design patterns or specified some design patterns, how can we evaluate what we have done to see whether it's useful or how it can be improved? So I'm moving ahead to the next slide with the title Requirements.
Okay, can you tell us what slide number you are on?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm using the version that doesn't have the slide numbers.
What does it say at the title?
Requirements. It's slide number 5, I think.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. So what are requirements for such theories, for such tools, for such techniques that allow us to do ontology design, pattern design, and engineering? Clearly, they should be fairly generic. They may come out of a certain domain or a group of domains, but they are probably not going to be too successful if they are too tightly bound to it. They also should be generic with respect to ontology languages. So if they are strictly tied to a particular form of maybe a description logic or some other, or even also a graphical design language, then they might not fulfill their potential. Clearly, they should be expressive, and that now ties back to the bottleneck picture. And Jana has hinted at this in the introduction. I have repeatedly voiced the opinion that we may be trying to do an impossible thing if we try to use the same languages that are intended to support machine reasoning for the design and the discussion of the ontologies that we design. So at some point we need to have more expressive languages. We may actually, if we do that, we may be able to use subsequently less expressive languages in the exposed products of our designs. So maybe with a simple RDF triple form of eventually representing our data and our vocabularies, we're doing just fine as long as we have more expressive means of designing them, modeling them. That's the distinction I'm making between modeling languages and encoding or machine reasoning languages. One more requirement, and there's probably more than I have on this list, but they should support composition. And that's, of course, the idea of building blocks. Somehow in that technique or tool or language or all of these that we are using to design patterns, it is really important to solve the problem of white wine not being the intersection of white things and wine things. And that's, of course, just one example. Composition of building blocks in general, maybe a fairly sound way of doing polymorphism. There is the idea of parametric polymorphism out of languages, and I'll get back to this vaguely at least with my proposal here, which is one way of doing that. And all of this preferably should be theoretically sound, coming with an understanding of what these constructs do and are, and what the meaning of the language terms, sort of the meta-language, is, so that we can better apply it to define the meaning of the target. And having said all of this, it should still be simple, or at least as simple as possible. So I'm advancing to slide number 6, and suggesting that, as I mentioned before, an old idea, the idea of behavioral abstraction, has actually a lot of promise for this. What's the idea of behavioral abstraction? I just tried to, and most of you are obviously familiar with this, I've just tried to remind you and illustrate it here with the duck test. If it looks like a duck, swims like a duck, and quacks like a duck, then he probably is a duck. And that's a way of thinking based on how things behave that appears to be fairly powerful. One of the reasons for the power seems to be that it tends to create less or shorter reasoning chains, shorter hierarchies of inheritance of concepts. Because these behavioral constructs, verbs in general, activities tend to have a bit shorter trees, a bit shorter hierarchies, but I won't expand on this at the moment. So I'm advancing to slide number 7. And trying to give you just a rough sketch of how I see behavioral abstraction enter ontology engineering. I can't do justice to this given the time restrictions, but I can at least give you the flavor. I think it's still very useful to start bottom up and documenting actual uses of terms, of concepts, of vocabularies. But maybe it's good enough to do this in a simple RDF form and collect existing forms that are out there, of course, and in applying this to the example of ducks, just see how this term is being used, how alternative terms are being used, but not make too much of a fuss about this being concepts or types that need to be standardized in ontologies. So that's the second bullet here. Treat these uses as inconsequential type declarations. So yeah, okay, these are ways of labels, nouns that people apply to certain phenomena in the world. But then that's the new idea, well, not the new idea, but the idea I'm suggesting to bring in here, define classes of these things, define classes of these inconsequential or otherwise types that we have. So the class of types or things of entities that swim. So the instance of this class would be things like ducks, but also possibly boats or people. The class of things that quack, maybe that's a bit of a smaller class. The class of things, animated things probably that talk. And this idea of abstracting from the type level, one level higher to the type class level, is something that appears semantically to be extremely powerful. And we just don't generally have the techniques and languages available to do that today in the ontology engineering business. And once we have done that, once we can do that, we can then start to inherit the behavior that these classes are characterized by, the swimming, the quacking, the talking, to the various types that we are interested in our ontology engineering. So let me move on, slide number 8, and give you quickly a formal view. I think I'm a bit, maybe Jana, you can signal me some time at some point. How much do I have left? I'm trying.
We have 6 minutes, Jana.
Okay, that's good. I'm trying to cover the remaining 4 or so slides in these 6 minutes. Don't be put off by the syntax that you see. I'm trying to give you a flavor of a syntax that I'll briefly introduce in the next slide and the language. Let's take a very simple behavior, the behavior of equality. All the things that we can compare for equality are reasonable members of this type class. And this is an idea that you might remember from things like measurement scales and nominal values that can be compared for equality are precisely the ones that you find in this class. How can we define such a class? We can say, okay, there's a class equal, which has a parameter A for all the possible instances, types namely, that belong to this class. And then we define these instances. But before doing this, we say, okay, what is the behavior? We just take an A and another A and compare them, and the result is a Boolean. And then we define instantiations for types like integers, types like points, type like ducks, and people. And for each of these types, we just have to say how they are compared for equality. So that seems a fairly straightforward application of the behavior abstraction idea with the simplest example I know, the equal behavior. And I move on to slide number 9 and now say a bit more about that language that you have just seen, and many of you have seen me talk about that before or have even used the language. Haskell, the modern day standard functional programming language, which I'm using rarely, occasionally as a programming language, but much, much more often as a modeling, as a software engineering, as an ontology engineering language. It has many properties that are extremely useful to do that. It has the cleanest type system, I think, that is known in the programming language literature. It has various higher order features. It is based on functions. Everything is a function. You can pass functions as parameters, etc. And we actually found this language in the early 90s when we were looking for an executable form of writing algebraic specifications in software engineering. And the last bullet on this slide, it has the very nice idea of multi-parameter type classes, the type classes we have just got to know. We have a single parameter type class, the equal type class. Haskell supports that, but it also supports type classes which have multiple parameters. So not just an A, but maybe an A, B, and a C. And here you see below these bullets, you see an example that is fairly complex already, and I want to briefly illustrate it on the next slide. Then just look at the second line that has an arrow first and then says path for link from to medium. This is a fairly complex type class that has 2, 4, 5 parameters to describe path types. A member or an instance of a path type can be a road, a bike path, a connection in the brain leading from one synapse to another, a pipe on the ground, any path that you can think of. The paths are reasonably characterized by where they are going from. Let me start with, there are passes for something that moves on them. They contain a link that connects a from and a to, and they go through a certain medium, which can be air or which can be water or something else. So without spending more time on this slightly hard to read syntax, let me move on to the next slide. And that's the example of the path class that we have just seen illustrated with the path design pattern that we've been working on in the GeoVocam series on the right-hand side. And I lack the time now to go into more details on explaining all the wild arrows here. But what you see is essentially the green arrows, that each of these parameters in the multi-parameter type class is being taken up by a concept, or in some cases a set of concepts or a whole group of concepts in the design pattern. And the way we came up with these blue blobs on the right-hand side in our design pattern for passes is by taking this specification that was first of all done in a fairly lengthy process of software engineering in Haskell to define a path type class. What you also see is that it led to two separate design patterns, one for paths and one for motion behavior, that are originally integrated in that algebraic specification in Haskell. So let me conclude. I try to illustrate with the bottleneck slide that we have a problem if we reduce meaningful communication to just set-based models, because we are losing all these things that I was illustrating as being thrown out of the window. And we may need, not in the ontology encodings, but in the design phase, some languages that are a bit richer. Also, just as a general argument, if we have problems like the ones that we are raising in this ontology summit, then it's always a good idea to look for theories around and techniques and languages that we have and could possibly bring to the task. So the idea that I was suggesting to bring to the task is number three here, to design ontology design patterns around behavior, shared behavior, and type classes in functional programming. And Haskell is just one illustrative example, a good one, a useful one, I think, as a language, are allowing us to do that. Just as sort of a perspective, I think what we are doing when we are applying these ideas is we are coming up with a controlled set of small, powerful theories, for example, about motion, for example, about transportation, maybe about swimming, that are then usefully combined to the various domain-specific and other concepts that we are modeling in ontologies. One example where you can see this, and this is what I've used as an example, is the GeoVocamp work. And on my last slide then, now moving on to slide 12 and raising the question, whether this solves the facts and mountains problem, but on the last slide, number 13, which I won't discuss, you will find some pointers both to the literature and to the GeoVocamps. But now what about the mountains? Have we solved the facts number of mountains problem? I think we have, because mountains are clearly objects that don't support the behavior of faxing, at least not normally, and if we had inherited their semantics from behavior classes that make sense for mountains, the error wouldn't have happened. Again, that was sort of a joking illustration of the idea, but I hope it makes the point that behavior abstraction is useful. Thank you all very much for your attention and interest, and I'm looking forward to questions.
Thank you very much, Werner. As always, in the Ontology Summit, so Ontology in general, we will have a joint session for questions at the very end. So let's move on now to our second speaker, which is Aldo Gangemi, who is a full professor at University of Paris 13. Aldo will talk today about knowledge patterns as one means to overcome ontology engineering bottlenecks. And I assume most of you know that Aldo is one of the leading figures in semantic web research and also ontology research, just to mention Deutsche. And he's also widely known as the person who brought this whole ontology design pattern into all our current debates and discussions. So I'm very happy to welcome Aldo. Aldo, the stage is all yours now for your presentation. After about 20 minutes, I will tell you that you have 5 minutes left to go. Looking forward for your presentation.
Okay. Thanks, Christoph, for the very nice introduction. Actually, I feel a bit flattered. But so the what I'm presenting today is is basically on a keynote that I gave on iSemantics in September in Austria, And the slides are available SlideShirt, so sometimes I will just refer to them if you want to go deeper in what I'm saying. So what I present here is how we can make a research in our lab, in Semantic Technology Lab at CNR and also in Paris, about the how to use in a top-down but also bottom-up way this notion of knowledge pattern. I'm quite happy about Werner's presentation because it's shown very well something that I was not going to show in my presentation. It's very good for me as well, and I subscribe most of what they say. So my argument, slide two, I'm the bad guy who forgot to number the slides. Sorry, Peter. So my first argument is that semantic technologies, and by semantic technologies I mean not just the semantic web, but also other technologies that support the activities for making semantic explicit in ICT, so including also NLP and other technologies, only sparsely address real semantic phenomena. And in the next slide, the reason is that semantic framing is not explicit. I will tell you what I mean by that. Next slide, four. And ontology-generated bottlenecks are one effect of this implicitness of semantic framing. And next slide, I would say then that we need an entity-centric, frame-oriented data science that could ensure relevance. Since the main problem of ontology-generated bottleneck is that people should feel motivated in joining the effort of providing schemas and rearranging and revising data, they are actually already doing that. If data analytics, even regular and traditional big data, they are actually struggling for dealing with relevance and find out the basic, the most important information out of this big amount of information and even knowledge that we already have. So the entity-centric view is maybe partly provided by the semantic web, which is maybe the main contribution that has been given by the semantic web. The frame-oriented data science is a bit less in the core. That's why I'm suggesting that frames and in the form of design patterns, but also of patterns that emerge out of data or of text, are very important. So next slide, I'm saying that semantic technologies then have progressed significantly, but they still need this relevant semantic phenomenon in social life. And next slide, seven, for example, how we can synthetically test what the text is about in the open domain without specific training, what is the core meaning, emotional content, position, and evolution of its topic. And the next slide, on the other side of things, how to analytically mesh up data in relevant ways in the open domain, i.e. without someone putting the necessary intelligence within. So these are promises that were made at the very origin of AI, but are still partly addressed. Next slide, nine, there are good examples of applications that would be quite cool, like data integration interpreted without designers, and without the risk of correlation fallacies, or when you interpret the possible correlations of data that are not really meaningful, or opportunistic reasoning for example, travel planning, or opportunities in finance, or how to automatically build teams, or to make smart summarizations, or making opinion mining on the right spots, or studying domain dynamics, like in science evolution, scholar changes, market. So next slide, 10. So one would say, okay, this is a very good opportunity for ontologists. But there are some doubts there, because we are not yet there in the large. And the reason, next slide, 11, is that even in basic ontology engineering, we are these bottlenecks that we are discussing, and some have been discussed in the thread and by email, and especially on sociological issues with even the term ontology that was in the past, or by experts that are not willing to give out precious know-how, or because they are not accustomed to reverse engineering their own conceptualization in the way that logic or the typical conceptual modeling techniques are willing they do. Or even because there is strong competition with traditional DP design, so there is no particular interest in changing the basic technology. So all these are sociological issues, of course, good examples of these bottlenecks and good motivations for these bottlenecks. On the other hand, I tend to reverse the argument line. I think that we need to grasp semantics where it is, independently of where we want to that people would put it, and to target the most natural way of expressing it. So this means to be, you know, less to state feasible objectives. So, for example, when semantic web started to grow, really was when we started analyzing data in the middle of last decade, and then we started really enforcing this idea of entity-centric computing, and also when we started adopting empirical science methods, and this is quite more recent actually. So we are trying to find real invariances in data and to study if something can be, some hypothesis can be evaluated and then confirmed for general use and general advantage. And also providing, the web provides something that is, I would find, well, robustness against incompleteness and errors. This was the key for Tim Berners-Lee at the time, for when he moved from hypertext to the web, accepting errors like the 404. And so something of semantic 404 is quite important to allow generalization of semantic technologies. So now the missing piece is this frame-based or knowledge pattern-based computing. And the next slide, 12, is about something that I'm not going to detail here because there is no room, no time. Is that human social knowledge management is never exempt from framing. So it is modulated by these frames as well by metaphors and stories. Maybe we are not really there, although at some point we should consider also these things because of the founding pieces of social influence. By the way, even staying in regular frames, this is something that is that makes something relevant. Through there are neural correlates, there are cognitive correlates, the linguistic correlates on that. And so start basing on what even already Marvin Minsky said in the middle of the 70s, we should try to approximate the kind of mechanisms that are activated and in the cognitive systems that are also used in AI. So an example, the next slide, very, very quickly, just to show you a concrete thing, what we have done in terms of entity-centric, frame-based, and empirical way is a bottom-up experiment we did. So we started from Wikipedia link popularity measures, and we found there is a classic small world effect in measuring how the links in Wikipedia distribute across the types of pages. What we try to experiment here is to discover regular knowledge patterns just from the association of types based on association, typical association of pages from the wiki links. So there are the references, I cannot really describe them attentively. But one example that really we discovered them, we found regularities actually, we found some clusters that are confirm some hypothesis. But interesting, we implemented it, and you can even try it, provided that our servers are not under stress like it happened in the last days. What is called in exploratory browsing is called serendipity. For example, if you in this EMU tool that we developed, designed based on this idea of knowledge patterns emerging from Wikipedia links, you can browse Wikipedia based on starting from an entity, and then from an entity, this entity will be shown according to a certain view based on the knowledge pattern that is typical for the type of that entity, for example, scientist. And then you can, you have some nice facilities like also adding links to current Twitter tweets or to Google News, and to find the explanation on the Wikipedia page, why there is a link of a certain type. But also you can make a difference. You can discover what is not obvious for a certain type of people, like it's not obvious for a scientist, next slide 15, could be associated to with a film, for example, to Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which is the case for Alan Turing, because he was fascinated by that movie, actually. So that is not a rocket science. It just shows that you can do things that can get to the what a user want to expect when making a deeper search based on finding invariances that are confirmed actually by the behavior of people on Wikipedia when they write Wikipedia links. So next slide, 16. So we are in the middle of this, these are the terminology typically related to what I'm trying to tell you, as probably close also to what Werner has told you, that so we have knowledge patterns, frames is the old word, the old term that is still very effective. So we have semantic patterns, ontology design patterns, best practices, requirements. Okay, I'm not just listing them. And then I give you a more coherent picture of all these different things that come from logic to content to interfaces. In slide 17, this is a broader vision. The idea that knowledge patterns can be considered as objects that have different facades. For example, in this model, this is one possible model that can be a larger structure or a smaller one if you want, but something that can connect actually what typical experts do, for example, when you collaborate with knowledge acquisition with experts, they often use these concept graphs without any formality. And if you are able to catch the boundaries of their concept graphs as something that could be useful to extract their own the domain patterns, this is extremely useful because then you can move from the C part of from the facade, the informal facade. You can then apply a generalized theory like the ones that Werner mentioned. So approaching the logical forms, the axiomatization of the predicates that are used in that could be used with these concept graphs, and also the local inference rules, either classical or approximate, for example, that could be used with these logical forms. And also you can find data patterns that are that can be described by these forms, and also you can use them to match to linguistic data that are that emerge out of NLP algorithms, for example, and so on. Okay, not just say the more and more complicated things there. But the interesting part is that there is a continuum of knowledge, that what we can call as the abstraction of the knowledge pattern, that holds different kinds of representations, different domains, in different ways of interacting with the world or stretching the knowledge about this interaction. So in the next slide, 18, I'm just paying use and saying that I'm a good company. For example, the first one of talking about knowledge patterns, and in a way that was very close to what Werner has presented, was Peter Clark. Was at Boeing for a long time. Now it's in Allen Foundation for AI. And of course, many others. I just mentioned them, and you can just look at the slide if you want. So the important thing here is that in many talks in the last couple of years, what is important is that we need one and more structure, but also that is automatically discovered, also more empirical aspects, more user-oriented patterns. And that this idea of a pattern that has knowledge at the center, not just a symbolic pattern like it's used in, for example, in image recognition, it's a very useful abstraction out of different studies, different practices. And of course, this is on the shoulders, next slide 19, of cognitive and neuroscientists. So slide 20, now going more specifically into semantic web expressivity. So is semantics used today enough to support extraction, representation, and harnessing of the relevant semantics? So triples, for example, are simple structures. And classes are represented strictly as arbitrary concepts, but they're typically not over time. So how to state the cognitive adequacy of introducing triples or classes? For example, when does a class represent arbitrary data and when it is a counterpart of a human-relevant knowledge pattern? One example in slide 21 comes from what we lose when we don't consider the empirical origin of our knowledge. So let's take the influence of DBPedia. It's wonderful, no? It's the core piece of linked data. So everything started from there in 2006. So in the recent semantic web. So what is scraped essentially the infobox data from Wikipedia, but still, no, what they lost apparently is that these infoboxes were organized internally in terms of subframes. More or less adequate, more or less appropriate, but they just didn't consider it. This is reasonable because they wanted just to put everything into tribals, and this is been so successful and useful that no one is going to blame them for that. Nonetheless, it would be interesting to recover them. For example, we can recognize administrative frames or geographic frames or communication frames within that that info box. So next slide is 22, no? And say that even if you mine the ontology of DBpedia to check what properties can apply to what classes, the result is partial, often even non-correspondent to the original frame and that was in the empirical part that was reused. So sometimes scraping heuristics, as dirty as it is, may be even more cognitively sound. This should tell a lot to us about the balance that we should give to what we find empirically and what user or things that develop based on what Christopher Alexander, the inventor of the term design pattern, told is useful in that moment. It should be balanced with what we have in terms of logical results, complexity, or good practices from top down. So next slide, 23, is I'm just saying that it's important to consider also interfaces and interaction patterns. But I would go quicker here. And 24, I would talk about empirical conservativeness as a property that comes out of these examples that I made. So what is present with the function in evident, extracted, or emerging empirical data should be preserved in its semantic representation. It is, of course, also for the schemas that emerge out of that. And this is, next slide, 25, is a measure against oversimplification. So the infobox framing loss is a sample violation of that principle. So 26 is keeping interaction boundaries is this special case of empirical conservativeness that connects to establishing boundaries at linguistic level or neural level, as I mentioned before. In 27, I'm saying that I'm not advocating for more semantics or even more expressivity in terms of more complexity, rather for more distinctions. So, for example, I observed that human knowledge is relational in nature in many cases. So the most important thing and linked data shows, linked open data actually shows the importance of relations rather than of classes in all this building and also the not beauty, non-beautiful things, but and then I think that we need, by the way, to organize these relations and having an array of multi-grade relations or arbitrary would be too much in current chaos scenarios. But this can be dealt with by using some smart verification patterns. An example, for example, is what Werner showed as a part of representation in R. On the other hand, this is useful to switch to the class view that is typical in description logic languages. So classes are powerful primitives in logical languages, especially in description logics or triple-based languages. And next slide, 28, this fixation on classes goes with a trade-off. So the idea is that classes need to be distinguished in terms of design. So if you, we need a kind of push-up to partially recover lost structures like we have seen in those info boxes. In 29, so we can imagine that we would have class types. This is not new. In the past, there would have been already sorts and types. Or in formal ontology, Nicola Guarini and Chris Welty proposed metaclasses in ontoclean based on formal criteria. But more pragmatically, now we have, in our queue, we have spanning that provides arbitrary typing of classes. And it's not really a construct that is heavily used today. It's interesting, by the way, to have these two streams, so the past formal ontology approaches that are more heavy principles versus just providing the possibility to do it without any principle at all, like panning. Sorry, go a bit faster. In 30, we should try to model what's special in that class. If it is central in data, or if it is a frame, or if it is a memory verification mechanism, or if it is the result of a discovery algorithm, kind of a vocabulary for these meta classes. And now we don't have much in Aula or RDF. Maybe we have the modules, but they're not really used a lot. But we have, of course, classes and named graphs and half key actions that could be very useful in AltQ, but they are not used a lot. They are not specific, by the way, to the boundary problem, not to this your framing or binding to what we have in cognitive terms. Good news is that very, very recent, a new specification for named graphs accepts the possibility of typing them. This was even unknowable before. Slide 32, we can also say that some efforts are doing in the right way. For example, linked open vocabularies is a good starting point to find out elements of vocabularies that are useful. For example, if we are interested in events, and you can put a query on the log side, and slide 33 shows the result. The interesting part is that each result taken can be filtered by domain and by vocabulary and by type, and this can help you in restricting the kind of elements that you want to use. This is not yet, of course, the framing effect, but goes in the right direction. We need something like that.
I'm trying to jump in here. 5 minutes to go.
Yeah, thanks, Christoph. I almost finished. So, slide 34. So the idea is that in order to overcome ontology engineering bottlenecks, the idea is that good design and automatic extension can have a date together. So there can be a useful knowledge pattern-based abstraction from text data ontologies, and KP can be directly reusable at design time. So just to show what this means is that 35, this is the classical definition of ontology design pattern, that is a reusable successful solution to a recurrent modeling problem. And in 36, there is the core slide about this dynamics between abstraction and instantiation of these patterns. So the example here is deliberately super simple. So it's simply that we have, at the logical level, we can have just a simple pattern that says that an out class is a subclass of some restriction. At the generic content level, like top domain pattern, we can have that an inflammation is a subclass of something that is localized in some body part. Then we have can have a more specific content pattern like that colitis, sorry for the example, that's not good before dinner, subclass of something localized in some colon. And then we could have an instantiation pattern like Jones colitis localized in Jones colon. And then we could have linguistic patterns that are carried out in a certain way. Okay, all this comes from the point that we have the general form and then we come down. But what is interesting for knowledge patterns is that we can discover these things going up from as an abstraction process from observing linguistic patterns and data patterns and generalize them in a useful way, but maintaining the notion of what we have discovered, what we want to discover, what we are extracting, what we are recognizing or detecting. And this gives, you know, by using some stupid meta class that says, I discovered it with this amount of evidence from data, from text, and whatever. So 37, another interesting part is studying how people are really using KR constructs. This is the empirical approach in finding, for example, when you have to represent N relations in RTF and DAO, what kind of constructs can be used? Okay, so based on some intuition of Pate's from many years ago, we have made some studies for some investigations to discover what are the most used or the most intuitive for people. And this is another part that is quite important, empirically testing what we have. Slide 38, almost done. This is an example of extraction from existing ontologies and data jointly. So, for example, here from Jamendo and other datasets concerning musical data on linked open data, we have applied some simple centrality discover algorithms and queries to that in order to discover what is the really core ontology that is used in those data. So this empirically shows that this is the real core ontology of those data, not the one that is produced possibly but not used. We discovered that some properties and classes are not used at all or just used in a very minimal way. It is important in order to give a clear interface or facade, or actually a facade could be in here, a facade to the data for a knowledge pattern, that is the record knowledge pattern. So to conclude, the last example is about extracting from text. So having the idea of frame-based and entity-based entry computing in mind, we try to use deep parsing to extract ontologies from text. And so you can go there and try it and use it also by APIs. There is a general page with all our tools and speed-up tools. Here, for example, you can just put the sentence and get slide 40, last slide. For example, you get these, you get a lot, actually you get more triples than what you say, what you see in that diagram. But you can see that you have a connected view. It's not just taking some entities from the text or extracting some sparse binary relations. It's an event-centric, frame-centric extraction that tries to put them all together and to link to existing knowledge. So here you clearly see how the groundwork is needed. So extraction from text and connection to data, linking to vocabularies, then to general knowledge expressed in a language that provides construction patterns there, like OWL. And this is what you get from a sentence. But if you take from many sentences or from many documents or from large corpora, more patterns should could appear, and you have another empirical way of testing how text-oriented knowledge can be used to enlarge our basis of patterns and how to establish what are the most recurrent ones also in abstraction terms. So sorry, I hope to have been quick enough to close in 25 minutes. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you very much, Aldo, for this wonderful presentation. One thing, maybe for all of you, sometimes it's difficult to keep the slides in sync, so the VNC is really optional. If you want to see the slides, you can also download them from the session's webpage. You all know where this is. Nevertheless, I'm pointing to it in the chat once more, and you can directly download the slides there. So thanks again, Aldo. The next speaker is Karl Hammer from Yunping University. I hope that's the right way to pronounce it, where he's working as a computer scientist. I had the pleasure to recently in being the reviewer of some of his new publications, and I think it's spot on for exactly this session, so we are super glad to have you here, Karl. Karl's talk today is about reasoning performance indicators for ontology design patterns, and I hope you see it really well blends into the previous two talks. Okay, Karl, the stage is all yours. After 20 minutes, I will give you a sign.
Excellent, thank you. So, hi, everyone. I really hope that the fire alarm won't go off any more times. It's gone off 3 times during Aldo's speech, and in that case, it will definitely drown me out. Sorry about that. So, I'm Karl Hammer, Jönköping University. If you can move to the second slide. As you can see here, I'm not as distinguished a scholar yet as the esteemed professors who preceded me. But I'm doing a PhD project, and it concerns ontology design patterns to a large extent, which explains why I've written this little paper that I'm going to talk to you about. This is the first time that I'm at Ontology Summit, first time I'm at the Ontologue community, and it seems very nice, so thank you for inviting me. If we can move to the third slide. So as a bit of context, what I'm doing I've just done my licentiate project. Now, the Swedish PhD is divided into 2 parts, and my licentiate project is the first part. And it essentially concerned the development of quality characteristics, quality indicators, measurement methods for those indicators, and so forth, for ontology design patterns. And basically, the motivation for this, which I think has been mentioned earlier tonight, is that a lot of ontology design patterns have been produced and presented, and it's sort of taken as a given that this is cool stuff that works really well. But as I've shown in a previous literature survey, it seems that ontology design patterns are not so much studied and evaluated themselves as artifacts, but rather sort of just presented, and there seems to be a lack of work in evaluating how they work and how they what features they need to display and so forth. So this motivates my work. I should also add that this work was presented at the workshop on ontology patterns at ISWC in November. So if you want to read the full paper, you'll find a reference towards the end of the slide set. If we can move to slide number four. So basically the motivation here is that we are using ontologies in all kinds of interesting places these days. We have seen a lot of work on stream reasoning recently. There's this intelligent agent stuff that's actually finally starting to happen, something with Siri and Google Now and all these things that could potentially use ontologies, although we don't know what they use on the inside. There's all sorts of information extraction challenges where, and in all these cases, reasoning performance is a key requirement. Now, if we want to use ontology design patterns to design ontologies for these purposes, we're going to have ontology design patterns that are in themselves reasoning performance efficient and that help you produce ontologies that are also reasoning performance efficient. And consequently, we need to know a bit more about what ontology design pattern features and characteristics that are useful for reasoning performance. So if we move to slide number five, the paper that I'm referencing here, or talking about, lists three research questions. The first of which is, what performance indicators that we know of or that have been published in literature can we also apply to ontology design patterns? The second being, of those ontology design patterns that are published in repositories on the web, how are these indicators displayed, or how performant are these? And thirdly, based on these findings, what kind of recommendations can be made in terms of creating new ontology design patterns and using ontology design patterns? Now, I should note, as noted here on the slide, that what I'm going to talk about here is content ontology design patterns. So if you look at the NEON typology for ontology design patterns, which is rather widely accepted, there are, I suppose, multiple perspectives on this, but this is the one I adhere to. You can have ontology design patterns classified for different purposes. So you have transformation patterns and naming patterns and so forth. But you also have content patterns, which are essentially small reusable OWL building blocks intended to be specialized when implementing your ontology. And that's what we're dealing with. Now, what I did is that I, a two-part process, did a literature study, as indicated by the research questions, to look at what's going on in the field, what type of performance indicators can we find in existing work that could also possibly be applied to ontology design patterns. Looked at a bunch of top conferences and accompanying workshops from 2005, when ontology design patterns were initially proposed by none other than Mr. Ganjimi, or Professor Ganjimi, through 2012, because this work was done in early 2013. And of course, this is not exhaustive. You know, there's many, many more workshops and conferences and journals and everything to study. But one has to delineate at some point, and this is enough to get a good starting perspective on the challenge and the issues. And secondly, then studied the two most popular pattern repositories on the web, in my perspective, ontologydesignpatterns.org, which came out of the NEON project, and otp.sourceforge.net, which I believe comes from the University of Manchester to begin with, if I'm not mistaken. If I am, you may, of course, correct me. And basically studied how these indicators are expressed in patterns that are located in these repositories. If we move to slide seven, please. So the process here, fairly simple. For the literature study, I downloaded all these papers, and there were hundreds, and I think there were even a bit above 1,000 mark. Couldn't read all of those, obviously. So read the abstracts, picked out those for further study, that mentioned in certain terms or certain concepts that seemed related to this topic, read those in detail. Ended up with, in total, 8 papers dealing with this, which seems rather few. But as I said, if you're looking at the studies of ontology design patterns, there's not that much done on those yet. And it seems also that the study of ontology engineering constructs, which are applicable to small ontologies in particular, is not that much done yet. The second step, if we go to slide number 8, was to download the associated OWL files from these repositories, calculate these indicator values for each ontology design pattern OWL file, and start to figure out, are there any correlations between these indicators in terms of between the performance indicators and themselves, or between performance indicators and other features of these ontologies or small ontologies, and or are there some interesting distributions of values going on? Now, if there were any interesting observations, I tried then to figure out some reasonable explanation or motivation for this, grounded in the OWL ontology language, grounded in ontology design pattern usage and methods, or ontology engineering tools and methods. The tool that I use to calculate all of these metrics is open sourced, and you can download it from the GitHub repository mentioned in the footnote here. It's a rather nifty little thing, pluggable, so you can build your own indicator modules and plug in and calculate across both ontology design patterns or full-scale ontologies or what have you. So have a look at that if you like. Now, if we go to slide number 9, so out of these 8 papers, there were a total of 11 reasoning performance indicators that were isolated. Studying these they gave cause for considering 12 recommendations on how to do reasoning friendly ontology design pattern and use, design pattern design and use. And it turns out that these recommendations could broadly be sort of summarized into 3 general design principles to consider. And these are not particularly, and you'll probably recognize these as good common practices. They're not very unusual. Yeah? And if we go to slide number 10, we can see those performance indicators found via the literature study. Now, a couple of these are obvious, in particular the ones concerning the OWL2 profiles. Obviously, patterns adhering to these profiles display reasoning characteristics which are consistent with those profiles' original design criteria. I'm sorry, it seems the fire alarm has gone off again here. Can you still hear me, everyone? Oh, no, it ended.
Yes.
Don't see any smoke, so I suppose I shall continue. In terms of OWL-Horst adherence, interesting thing, OWL-Horst is parallelizable to a large degree, so you might want to stay in that small subset of OWL if you want to do scalable reasoning. When we have class in degrees and class out degrees and cyclomatic complexity, these 3 at the very top concern the RDF graph, the underlying RDF graph, where class in degree and class out degree denote the number of in and outgoing arrows from class nodes, and cyclomatic complexity, or the cyclomatic complexity measure often used in software engineering and whatnot, essentially denoting the type of cycles in the RDF graph. Won't go into that in detail because it's tricky. Depth of inheritance concerns subsumption. Basically, the deeper the subsumption hierarchy, the trickier to compute, apparently. Existential quantification count, I'm sure you understand. General concept inclusions is a bit unusual to see these days, but it's axioms where you have complex classes on the left-hand side of the axiom, essentially. That is also apparently associated with performance, poor performance hotspots in ontologies when doing reasoning. And at the bottom, tree impurity and tangledness, essentially 2 different perspectives on the same type of construct where you have, they denote how far an OWL or an ontology diverges from being a one-parent tree. So basically, how many cases of multiple inheritance or multiple parents do you have? Now, in the coming analysis slides, I should mention that the OWL profiles that is noted here has been studied by a lot of other people and discussed by a lot of other people. So that's not covered. Cyclomatic complexity, I had some severe trouble with actually measuring in a reasonable way. And so instead of making assumptions and analysis based on possibly faulty data, that has been left out. Now, if we move to slide 11, we can start looking at the individual indicators and a couple of them. I note that there's a spelling error in the title. Sorry about that. On this slide, the gray solid line denotes the class in degree, the average class in degree, and that is the axis on the right-hand side of the diagram. Now, seems most ontology design patterns have an average class in degree of below 4, which there's a few that stand out there. Testing this against other, mapping this against other structural characteristics and indicators of these OWL files, I noted that there seems to be a slight correlation here against the number of object properties. Of course, this is not a very clear link, but it was worth considering what this may be because of, if there is really a reason for this. And the hypothesis and idea is that this is to do with domain and range restriction axioms associated with number of object properties, because best practice is that when you create object properties, you define domains and ranges for them. And domains and range restriction axioms give rise, obviously, to ingoing edges, to classes. If you think of the triples that will be created by this. So if we know that average class in degree, having an average class in degree is a poor, is associated with poor reasoning performance, this may lead us to suggest that we should be careful with the number of domains and range restriction axioms that we put into our object properties. If we move to slide 12, this looks at the opposite, average class out degree. Again, this correlation is not, of course, entirely clear in any way, but there seems to be a slight indication that if the gray line here is class out degree and the dashed line is the number of anonymous classes, there seems to be something potentially going on here. And the hypothesis idea here is that it seems that ontology design patterns with a higher class out degree are such ontology design patterns where class restriction axioms are used more. And since class restriction axioms are expressed as subclasses or equivalent class axioms on classes, such that some class is a subclass of a particular constraint or an equivalent class to a particular constraint, which is an anonymous class, this would possibly explain this linkage. And average class out degree is also associated with not so good reasoning performance. If we go to slide 13, depth of inheritance, it was found when looking at ontology design patterns that they are generally very shallow. So there's probably not that much cause for concern here in terms of reasoning performance. Should be noted that ontology design patterns from these two different portals are slightly different in that the odps.sourceforge.net ones include examples in the downloadable OWL file, whereas ontologydesignpatterns.org keep examples in a separate OWL file. So they're not entirely comparable, strictly comparable. But in general, it seems that depth is not a big issue in ontology design patterns. If we move to slide 14, existential quantification count, we can note that around 60 of these ontology design patterns contain existential quantification axioms or cardinality restriction axioms of size 1, which is equivalent, essentially. Of these, this is sort of a rough grouping, simplification, if you will, of course. But about half, 31 of them, contain one or two axioms. And these are generally used sort of sparingly when I could obviously see they're required, if you will, if you look at the pattern documentation. Whereas if you look at the remaining 29, the other 29 that have a bit more of them, again, it's a bit of a simplification, but here you can more often see that these axioms are used in ways that may be unnecessary. I'll give some examples here on the slide. So this could be a cause for concern if we know that the number of existential quantifications is associated with poorer performance, then obviously we don't want to have more of such axioms than necessary, or strictly necessary. Moving to slide 15, general concept inclusions. There's a bit of an explanation of what a general concept inclusion is here, because this is not a type of axiom which is very commonly used in the semantic web community that I found. There's a great blog link down in the footnote there, which I recommend you look at. It was found that no patterns displayed such general concept inclusion axioms at all, so this is not at present a problem of any sort. Probably because there is no support or very little support in tooling for constructing such axioms. So let's try to avoid those if we want to stay performant. Moving on to slide 16. In terms of tangledness or tree impurity, it seems that this is also rather uncommon in ontology design patterns. Of all the patterns studied, three of them displayed any degree at all of asserted tangledness, that is, multiple parents per class. And in these three patterns, each one of them had only one occurrence of a multi-parent class. Now, of course, this is when looking at the asserted axioms. Running this through a reasoner, the image could change, and the inferred tangledness could be significantly higher. But that's rather tricky to measure in a good way, so that's work remaining to be done. I've not looked at that now. So moving to slide 17, and I'm actually running through this quite quickly, but it gives more time for discussion, I suppose. Here we have a subset of the design recommendations that are listed in this paper as a result of this work. So essentially, limiting the use of class restrictions to the minimum required is recommended in order to stay performant. Limiting the use of existential quantification axioms is likewise. And here I would recommend that even if, as I write here, even if the addition of an axiom makes sort of real-world intuitive sense to you, which I saw a couple of patterns where people had put in axioms that seemed to make sense, even to me, but were perhaps not strictly necessary in terms of the requirements of those ontology design patterns, looking at the competency questions, which are the formalized requirements. If possible, you should look into rewriting general concept inclusion axioms into such axioms that are not associated with poor performance hotspots. Looking at properties, as mentioned, limiting the number of domain and range requirements to the minimum as put upon by the ODP requirements is recommended. And in terms of constructing class restriction axioms, again, look at this this issue of inferred tangledness. If possible, avoid such axioms which give rise to unions and intersections of classes that are from different branches in the subsumption tree to the greatest degree possible, because that will lead to tangledness, which is associated with poor performance. So moving on to slide number 18, which is actually the last slide, I think the general take-home message from this is don't over-specify. If you have a set of requirements, make them explicit and fulfill only those requirements. I saw several cases where patterns did more than was strictly required by the competency questions, which are, in essence, their requirements. And of course, that is neat, but it is not necessary, and it may lead to poor performance. Second bullet point, rewrite if needed. The conceptual solution provided by the ontology design pattern, as described in the associated documentation in a portal or a repository, may make a good amount of sense. And if that particular ontology design pattern is not in the OWL profile that you want, or if it displays features that you do not, that are not associated with good performance for your use case, it's quite all right to rewrite the ontology design pattern. Is it the ontology design pattern? Is it the OWL file or the page on the web that describes the problem and solution? Well, I would argue that it can be more, there would be more the web page describing, or the sort of the conceptual solution, rather, not the web page, describing the problem and solution pair. The OWL file itself is simply an implementation, which can be rewritten if needed. And the third bullet point, and this is particularly important, I think, is ensure that this documentation exists, because in order to design good patterns that where you don't overspecify, and in order to be able to rewrite patterns, the first two bullet points, there needs to be good, solid quality documentation in terms of the competency questions, in terms of how to implement the problem and solution. And unfortunately, many design patterns these days have insufficient, that are published on the web, have insufficient documentation, are lacking in terms of textual description, are lacking in terms of competency questions, and are lacking in terms of graphical illustrations. So the third point, I think, is particularly important. If you are going to be releasing patterns, be serious and write the documentation as well. You know, documentation is no fun, but it needs to be done. I think I've finished there, because that's the last slide. So, yeah, thank you.
Perfect, great. Thank you so much, Carl, for the very interesting presentation. So first of all, thanks to all the speakers that worked out really well. We are in time. We have 30 minutes left for general discussions. So Pascal had to leave as he has to teach, so there's still Matthew and me to moderate that, and of course, as always, Peter is the important, most important person behind that to moderate all of that. I would propose that if you would like to say something, you can raise your hand in the chat. I hope you see that option in the chat, and then Peter can go ahead and unmute you, or you can unmute yourself pressing *7, and we can dive directly into the questions for any of the three speakers, or maybe general questions. If you are a speaker, I hope you also see that there have been some questions posed in the chat. Okay, so who would like to start? Are there any specific questions? Okay, Michael Gruninger is raising his hand. Michael, I hope you can just unmute you pressing *7.
Thank you, Christoph. I thought the questions that you had on your slide 3 of your introductory slides were really, really interesting questions. I mean, nice to hear the speakers maybe at least address the first question that you had there. How to arrive at reusable patterns? Are there different types? How many are there? Just to get the speakers' insights on those questions.
I do, Werner, Carl. Keep in mind to press *7. Okay, so while Aldo is unmuting, or Werner or Carl are unmuting, we in fact discussed the question of how many patterns there are during Dachstuhl's seminar on the related topic. And from what I recall, Aldo said that he expects that there may be thousands of patterns. And the question is, of course, what types of patterns. So there are probably way more content patterns than logical patterns. But we try to quantify this in, for instance, referring to books. So you could have a paper of different logical patterns, but probably books of content patterns. So I hope that Aldo or Werner are unmuted now, or Carl, if you'd like to jump in.
Actually, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thanks, Christopher. You're referring to the question in slide 5, bullet 3, right, of Carl's?
No, I think Michael was referring to the intro slide, slide 3. Correct me if I'm wrong.
I can't understand the set of slides you are referring to. Sorry, maybe I just lost something.
Oh, sorry. So in the introduction slide that I gave at the very beginning.
The introduction slide. Oh, sorry.
Yes,
yeah.
You can see them in the VNC right now, or you can download them on slide 3. I had a list of questions. And if I remember correctly, Michael asked whether you or Carl or Werner could comment on the first question, how to arrive at reusable ontology patterns, and the second, how many patterns are there?
So I have something to say here. So how to arrive at reusable patterns, I would say that there are, as I tried to say maybe too quickly in my presentation, we have two sources actually. So the traditional one that we worked in 2000, but actually it was already before, is to leverage on the existing good practices by leading scholars or by people that really implemented projects that worked quite well. So the repositories like ODP and the ODPS from Manchester and others are actually based on that idea that you can prove that you can solve you can use some models, for example, to resolve recurrent problems. On the other hand, from the beginning, we realized that in order to have a sped up and rigorous approach of ontology design that is partly automatized and robust, you should also use some more domain-oriented patterns. This is somehow object of discussion. For example, Rinkex was the first from Amsterdam, was the first to point to know maybe that this design pattern should be as general as possible, or as abstract as possible, in order to be really easy to reuse. But when going, this is maybe is true with logical ones, but when you go to content ones, I object that it's important to have some kind of order there, some partial order that can correlate domain patterns that can emerge from, can distinguish them from the general ones. And usually domain ones add something, and then you have problems of a kind of a compositional algebra for patterns that we partly address, but this is not completely studied yet. There was some work actually in the end of the 90s by people that I don't remember actually the article that was very, very good. But on the other hand, I think that the reusable patterns could also be discovered empirically. That was the main point in my presentation. And when you discover them empirically, you may already know that they are grounded. So they are grounded in data, they are grounded in language, or they are grounded in web usage. Take, for example, microformats that are used in, for search engine optimization or for annotating web pages. So how many patterns are there? A lot. I would say if we consider content ones and we want to kind of imagine a kind of encyclopedia of patterns. If we have to look also at the possibility of abstracting them and then to get at the very general ones, I'm also confident that it's possible. But you cannot start from the top. It's kind of a mutual getting closer between the two.
Jano, do you want to think? I think Aldo is the man to answer these questions, and he just did. I was not suggesting that the software engineering type of higher level abstraction method really tells us what patterns we can come up with. This is, in my view, almost entirely orthogonal. The way I look at what patterns are useful is with my spatial lens on, and I have been fascinated by theories in cognitive linguistics that make the point that some basic spatial patterns like the path that I showed, like the link, like center periphery, like container, like support, are really very powerful, if you want, semantic structuring means. And I've just been, there's various names for these things like image schemas, etc. And as some of you know, I've been trying to apply this to semantic modeling, to ontology engineering. But this has nothing to do per se with the method of designing type classes or class types, how all they call it. So I would think it needs an external, not method-driven inspiration. And this can be a domain theory or especially the empirical work that we have seen presented now or any other creative idea. That's for the first question. The second one, I agree with all the many. And depending on how, at what level you count, it's really a multi-level game that we are playing, and there's probably clusters of patterns which are themselves clusters. And frankly, not meaning to be negative about this question, it doesn't matter to me. We can have as many as we want, and then the useful ones will survive.
Okay, thank you very much, Werner. Are there other questions?
Well,
Michael is raising his hand again. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, can I just follow up on that then? So why do we have, what are we talking about ontology patterns? If ontologies were meant to, they arose out of the shareable, reusable knowledge base project back in the late 80s, early 90s, and so ontologies were the reusable aspect. And then so people realized, in order to actually, integrate ontologies, in order to build new ontologies, you want to try to abstract away some design patterns, and hopefully that's kind of a smaller set so we can, build very complex ontologies from the small set of building blocks. And now we're saying, ontology patterns are thousands. Actually, there's more ontology patterns than there are ontologies now. So then why are we bothering talking about ontology patterns? Don't they just seem to be well-designed ontologies? Just a devil's advocate view here.
No, that's nice, pilot. I think that, definitely, there is a difference. So an ontology pattern is something that in the current examples and definitions has some properties. For example, solves one particular problem, particular modeling problem, typically related to one requirement or for one complex equation with exceptions, with possibly negative exceptions, but still not something that can be under control. And there are cognitive aspects on how big, how large a knowledge pattern typically is. So some come with the P2P related idea of the magical number, but typically, if you look also at the patterns that have been designed by linguistic people like FrameNet, for example, they typically have a size of 5 to 9 typical roles that are used, semantic roles that are used with each frame. And there is a grounding, on textual aspects, on the center, the centrality of data, and other things. So I imagine that one thing is to develop a pattern for this particular, with these particular properties. And another one is just to define an ontology. An ontology is a vague object that is can be used. For example, you can develop an ontology for Microsoft SharePoint and just for classifying text more or less automatically put there 1,000 tags that are not even formal, so that is still called ontology. But even if we confine ourselves to a formal meaning of ontology, ontology is as large as anyone wants to use it and does not respect in principle any cognitive principle. And in case you build it out of knowledge patterns or ontology design patterns, still it is not an ontology design pattern. It's just made of, in a modular way, out of ontology design pattern. An ontology as an artifact has to conform to larger requirements that have to do with sustainability in an enterprise, coverage of terminology and requirements in general, and appropriateness to certain tasks and applications. So I think there is still a good difference. And of course, what I'm advocating here is that by using patterns that could be either provided from the top or from discovering them in your domain, for example, and generalizing them, you can make better ontologies and facilitate the design. But, I don't know if I answered your question that way.
Thank you very much. Maybe one note about that. Let's also keep in mind that those patterns are supposed to be part of a larger stack, right? So that you use those patterns to jointly develop small, application-driven ontologies that are then you know, aligned to each other because they have both common patterns as ground. Maybe we move over to Mike Bennett's question. He's raising his hand since a while. Mike, star 7 to unmute.
Yeah, on ontology design patterns, do people see a distinction between patterns which are what I would call archetypical, i.e. a pattern that is the simplest kind of thing in some possible hierarchy of concepts? So, for example, a contract, what is the simplest thing that is a contract, such that if you take away one property of it, it's no longer a contract, it's a deed or something else, or the simplest kind of thing that's a transaction and so on. Those kind of archetypical patterns are what I've always thought of in terms of ontology design patterns, but I'm hearing maybe more sort of patterns further down the hierarchy. Is this a useful distinction? Is it one that's documented in different ontology design patterns, or is it a whole other thing?
May I rephrase your question, Patty, if I understood it well? So you are saying that if you are still wondering if we have to count on a very small list of archetypical patterns versus the idea that you have patterns in the large, is it correct?
Yes, okay. That's correct.
Thanks, Mike. Yeah, I tried to address it before. So, sorry for taking the meeting, but I already discussed it. And I still think that there is a difference between archetypical patterns and the ones that you can discover from whatever context and grounding. The problem that I would like to put it is into an empirical perspective. So the point is that would be very nice, actually fantastic, to have a complete repository of the archetypical patterns. It's another way of rephrasing the old dream of neo-positivism in logic and philosophy from the 30s and of 20th century. So the idea that you can have an extensive set of primitives that are not called primitives anymore, but they are called archetypical patterns, that can describe all possible ways of organizing our knowledge. That would be fantastic. And I don't think this is unfeasible, although I'm pretty skeptical about anything that is completely, that is totally complete and inalterable. But still, I think that there is a long way to do that. And but they have to be discovered. So that something, of course, comes from existing abstractions. For example, cognitive schemas like path, container, and configuration, and the others, coming, for example, from Gestalt psychology, could be useful candidates, but many others from mathematical theories that are, of course, abstract enough to be used. If you look at the early work on knowledge patterns by Peter Clark, he tries exactly to do that, and he even suggests that we should use category theory to found the semantics of these archetypical patterns. And I'm pretty confident that the most part, if not all patterns that could be discovered in the large, could be abstracted as primitive ones, or compositions of those, or modifications of those. But, you know, this is an interesting problem, actually. We don't have it yet. We have some examples of these generalizations, and foundational ontologies are also related to that. For example, the original Dolce design was actually taught in terms of different patterns to be put together. Only at the time we didn't talk about patterns, or we didn't do that way. But and also there were ideas that if you modularize too much, you lose some properties of the composition of the theory. So there is a trade-off there, certainly.
Thank you very much, Aldo. I have two questions for the other speakers, so maybe I start with the more generic one, which is to Werner. So what was interesting for me in Werner's talk is that he mentioned that just because we have a well-working knowledge representation language, like, for instance, the web ontology language, does not mean or should not imply that this is at the same time the right language to model ontologies, right? We have something similar in programming. There are many object-oriented programming languages, but we often use for the modeling tools like UML that can then be translated to those. So Werner used Haskell as an example of such a modeling in contrast to an encoding language. But let me ask about the specific requirements, Werner. What would be the requirements for an ontology modeling language in contrast to the what we have from the knowledge representation language? So abstracting over Haskell, what would be the requirements for such a modeling language?
All right, good question. I did have on my slides early on, I forget, about the fifth or so, a list of requirements that are maybe not language specific, but I think most of these five or so bullets about, you know, the ease of use, of course, but also the expressiveness, the ability to combine patterns are the ones that we want to see in the language. And beyond that, you know, there's a bit of, I'm very liberal about people's preferences for different styles of doing modeling. I'm just saying, to me at least, and it may be my, you know, small brain, I find it a mystery how one can use any of today's ontology languages to actually understand the problem and work out the design, discuss in a team whether this design captures the semantics, is valid for the data, supported by the conceptual schema, et cetera, et cetera. This seems extremely hard to me, but people who are more experienced with any, you know, iCypher or other language may be doing this just fine. So I'm just talking about my way of doing ontology, and we have been doing this, of course, in various settings like the GeoVo camps. I need something that is at a different level. And personally, I also need something that is not just a nice diagram drawing language. On that slide where I have the path example, you saw on the right-hand side with the bubbles, the you know, the essentially the concept map for the path and the motion schema. And that's great. And it presents in a succinct form the model before going into OWL or anything else, but it's still not something that I can use to understand what I'm doing, to reason. And I need a language that is a bit more powerful on not just in expressiveness, but also in terms of actually telling me something about my models. And the nice thing about the programming language, any, is that it, of course, builds executable models, and these models can be run, and you can test them on data. And the running of the models, as well as the type checking, of course, tells you things about the consistency, the completeness, the overall, you know, integration of what you're doing in your model with other aspects that you may have modeled already. And that may also be my answer to Pascal's question that you raised in the chat. Why do you need functional programming to bring to the game? You don't need to, but it just buys you a lot of additional power for, with a safe typing system, a sound typing system, executable models, testing, and that's the kind of things I'm looking for. But that's just my taste in these models.
Thank you very much, Werner. I would have one more question, and please raise your hand if you have other questions or type them in the chat. So one thing that Carl said on one of his very slides, I thought that this was very controversial, but nobody raised it in the chat, so I'm going to do it here. I'm sorry if I misparaphrased you, Carl, so please correct me if I'm wrong. You said that general concept inclusions are rare and should be avoided. So I agree that they are rare, but they are rare because, and I think you pointed to that, because of the poor tool support, right? I think that to some degree, a lot of bad ontology engineering habits comes from the restrictions of the tools. I really love Protégé, but it makes you think very centric on the concept and exclude general concept inclusions. I would say, Carl, that general concept inclusions are the key if you want to have something more than surface semantics, so more than just, you know, inheritance relations, but if you want to encode semantics on a deeper level. And in fact, in many of our ontology design patterns, we make heavy use on there of general concept inclusions. Could you maybe comment a bit about the statement you made there?
Sure thing. So, as I recall, the issue with general concept inclusions, and mind you, when building an ontology using ontology design patterns. Obviously, performance is not the only aspect to consider, as someone mentioned in the chat. It's one of many considerations. But what we do know is that with existing reasoners, and Pellet in particular, I believe it was, certain performance penalties are associated with the use of general concept inclusion axioms. If that's acceptable, or if you're planning to use perhaps a reasoner more suited for these axioms, then perhaps the same constraints do not apply. And absolutely, I think you're right in that it is largely in effect the reason why there are no general concept inclusions in the patterns studied is largely in effect of the tooling not supporting it, not recommending it. It does seem to me, I'm not very familiar with this type of axioms, I should say, but it seems to me, based on what I've read, among other things in this link that was in the footnote, that they do seem to encode a nifty solution, if you will, to certain types of modeling challenges. So I can certainly see situations where they would be very, very useful. Does that answer the question?
Yes, thanks. Great. Thank you very much. Other questions? We have about 6 minutes left. You can either raise your hand or type them into the chat. So maybe while you are thinking about your next questions, let me do one thing more. This is session one of the bottleneck track. There will be a second session in a few weeks from now. And while this one was more on strategies and building blocks, the next one will be on experience reports and guidelines, and we will have speakers such as Oscar Korchuk to report on that one. So if there are no other questions, then I would say we are done for today. Of course, feel free to stay in the chat for some more minutes, but I think if nobody's going to raise their hand, I'm going to formally close the session. Is there anything more for us to do, Peter?
No, except to thank you and Pascal and Matthew for putting this together, and thank everyone for coming, and to let them know that we'll have another session from Track D next week, same time, and hope everyone will be here again.
Thank you very much to everybody. Thanks to all of you for joining us on the call. Thanks again for our three wonderful speakers. You guys have a great day or evening or night or whatever. Bye-bye.
Thank you all.
Bye-bye. Great session.